Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Stephen Downes in this episode. Stephen was an early adopter of educational technology whose work will likely be familiar to you. Stephen was part responsible for the world's first MOOC, and his philosophically informed innovation and breadth of perspective continues to positively challenge the practice of open and online education. It's a pleasure for me to be talking with Stephen Downes, Senior Research Officer with the National Research Council in Canada. Stephen is well known internationally for his commentary about online education, and he circulates the OL Daily, an email newsletter, alongside his voluminous writings and commentary on subjects including all elements of open education and innovation. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure to be here.
Stephen, can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I've been in this for a while now, since, I guess, 1995 or earlier, depends on how you count it. I began doing educational MUDs, multi-user dungeons, way back when. Really took off when I started working with Assiniboine Community College in Brandon, Manitoba, Canada. Yeah. There, I built a bunch of online courses for them. I built their website. I built an LMS, and I did a whole bunch of training for staff and people in Western Manitoba. Went to University of Alberta. I built a system called MuniMall, and it was a one-stop resource information and community portal for the municipal sector in Alberta, so that'd be town managers and elected officials. And then after that, I came to the NRC. Some of the early work I did, I wrote a paper on learning objects. I wrote a paper on the future of online learning. I was involved with RSS in the early days for content syndication online, and I wrote some articles about that. I wrote an article called Educational Blogging for EDUCAUSE, which was pretty popular, and I was one of the very first education bloggers. Did podcasting in the early days. Podcasting's all the rage now. People forget that it's, more than 15 years old.
Yeah.
Just hadn't been popular until recently. Although it had a bit of a, there was a wave there for a little while. In mid to late 2000s with George Siemens, my colleague from Manitoba came up with and defined the theory of connectivism, yep, which is the idea that knowledge is the organization of a network and learning is the formation and manipulation, traversing of connections in that network.
Right.
And George and I also created world's first MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, in 2008, again with the University of Manitoba. More recently, I did a fair amount of work on personal learning and personal learning environments. I built a system called Grasshopper. That's something that I use for MOOCs, but it's also what I use to produce my newsletter. And it's my own personal learning environment. It's not a commercial product. It barely works, but it does work, and it's more of a research platform.
Yeah.
And most recently, I've been looking at things like distributed, decentralized networks, content addressable resources, some cryptographic applications like blockchain and different approaches to identity. Basically the next wave of e-learning. I wrote a paper way back when called E-Learning 2.0, and more recently I've been offering a course called E-Learning 3.0 that looks at the impact of things like cloud and open data, blockchain, AI, etc. on the world of online learning. So that's basically the career in a nutshell.
It's a mighty full nutshell. So, Stephen, you've got an unusual background in that you're very technically oriented. You've obviously done your own programming, but your background is also philosophy. Can you talk a bit about that?
I started off university as a physics major because I wanted to be a scientist, but my math wasn't strong enough. And as well, it turned out, you know, like as a physics major, you have to take a humanities option. All the English classes were full. So I took a philosophy course, and was my best grade. And it turned out I have an affinity for philosophy. And that's, you know, the 10,000 hours of reading science fiction probably did that for me.
Right.
So, yeah, my degrees are in philosophy. And, you know, I focus on philosophy of mind and epistemology, philosophy of science. Dabble in some logic, which came in very handy when it comes to computer programming. And there always has been and always will be a philosophical bent to anything that I write. And that gives me a very different approach to writing about education as well, because I write like a philosopher, not someone doing pseudoscientific research.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So who are some of the philosophical names that have most influenced you?
Well, David Hume, I guess, would be the first one, who is the 18th century British or Scottish empiricist. Ludwig Wittgenstein is very important to me. The later Wittgenstein, much more so than the early Wittgenstein. John Stuart Mill, to a large degree, on social and political philosophy. I think those would be the major influences.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned MOOCs too, the first MOOC. That was a what would be known as a C-MOOC, isn't it, as opposed to an X-MOOC. So it's much more community-focused. How did that go, that particular MOOC?
George and I were talking about connectivism, and George had the idea of doing an online course, and I thought that was a great idea, and that we should do our online course according to connectivist theory, which kind of made sense. And we wanted to do the course because nobody understood what connectivism was, and we tried to explain it and nobody understood. So we figured we'd demonstrate it. So we set up this course, and because it's a connectivist course, what we wanted to do is have it as decentralized as possible and to focus on the connections between people and between resources and people and resources and resources, you know, just to make it a decentralized network.
Yeah.
So we used Moodle a little bit for discussions. We used Google Groups. We used Twitter, because it was not long after Twitter started.
Yeah.
We used my Grasshopper application to aggregate RSS feeds and to create a course newsletter. And then we launched the course. And, you know, we're figuring 20, 25 people because it's a pretty niche topic.
Yeah.
And we got 2,200 people, which if we had been doing a traditional course, would have wrecked the course, right? Because, you know, how do you do a traditional course with 2,200 people? But, you know, typically, you know, you're having course sections of 20 or 30 people. And you needed to do it that way just because, you know, for the personal attention and for grading especially. But because we designed it as a network and because the participants were as implicated in teaching the course as the teachers, and the teachers were as implicated in learning during the course as the learners, it worked out. And it was no problem to have 2,200 people. And that led some commentators, specifically Dave Cormier and Brian Alexander, to call our course a MOOC, a massive open online course. And it was the first one of those, therefore.
Are there plans to repeat that?
Probably not that specific course. We offered that course four times.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's quite a few archives up still. You know, maybe we will, but we've both offered other courses over the years. The e-learning 3.0 course that I offered last fall, plan to offer again this fall, that was a CMOOC, a connectivist MOOC. So there will continue to be CMOOCs, but probably not that specific course.
Fair enough. Well, we'll certainly draw some attention to that on our website as well. Stephen, can we move on to the ideas and themes that your work has provided that you sense are still pertinent today? I'd imagine there's quite a few themes that you can draw on.
I think the first and most important is the idea of free learning, or open learning, if you will.
Yeah.
That's what my work has been about since day one, right? Things like blogging and RSS, all of these have been, focused toward making learning something that is accessible to everyone. With this and with any other contribution that I've made, it isn't that I've made this contribution. It's that I've been part of this larger group of people who have made this contribution. And I think that's an important thing to recognize. I didn't invent open education, clearly. I don't know if any individual invented open education or free learning or RSS syndication or even RSS for learning, whatever. It's, as they say sometimes, it's the chorus who does these things. And the other thing, I call it these days personal learning, but it's the general idea, and it's been expressed by people like Seymour Papert and John Holt and many others, the idea that individuals, learners, should be in control of their own learning. There's a fine line between education and propaganda, and that worries me. And I think that the best effect and the most ideal effect of education is when people are able to access learning or engage in learning activities in pursuit of whatever it is they're in pursuit of. If they want to build a motorcycle or travel the world or cure cancer or be an astronaut, any of these, all of these and many other things besides are, awesome objectives. And it should be the objective of learning, of the education system, to support people in that rather than to shape them or direct them toward specific occupational outcomes. That begins to start treating people as a means to an end, a means to someone else's profit rather than a person with worth and merit in their own right.
Yeah.
So, again, nothing I've invented, obviously, but my contribution toward that, I think, is important, and at least it is to me, maybe not to other people. That's the sort of thing I'd want to be remembered for. And then just generally, and I've said in jest in the past, on my tombstone, I want them to write, "Helped build the internet," because it's the greatest information communication system in the history of the world, and I'm just pleased to be a part of that.
Excellent. Can I just pick up on your personal learning comments? So certainly at the tertiary level, there's no requirement for a student to take any qualification other than the one they most want to pursue. Is that compatible with your philosophy, or am I missing something there?
There's the one view of this where, they're free to do whatever they're free to do unless we force them to do something else. So unless you're being forced, you're totally free.
Yeah.
But there's an awful lot that goes into a society besides force. For example, educational opportunities, places at a university, say, right? And a government will fund, say, 30 seats in pharmacology because they need 30 pharmacologists to fill industry positions. And so you have this idea of an education system as a provisioning system of skill sets for employers. And then that's where all the funding is directed. That's where the research is directed. You know, there's a whole range of activities today being devoted to competencies, competency measurements, micro-credentials, stackable credentials, all with the intent of seeing education as a means to help industry get workers. And, you know, none of that is about coercion. But, you know, if your choices are you can get educated to get a particular job or you can not get educated at all, there's not really freedom in any real sense. So I'm looking for ways of making, you know, not just employment opportunities, but the full range of educational opportunities available to people. You know, I used to work in Northern Canada, and in Northern Canada, all the programs that you could get access to were things like social work, you know, a healthcare clinician, things like that, because that's what they really needed up in the north. But, you know, there are people there who were really good mathematicians. You know, if you're living and working in one of these communities, there are no learning opportunities to become a mathematician. You know, you have to be a social worker. And I always thought that was silly.
Stephen, we're coming up to the end of 2019 now. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
It's a system in flux, for sure. I've been saying for many years that there's going to be a crisis in higher education, and it's going to be one of these crises that takes 15 years to build up to and then will happen overnight.
I
think that we're getting closer to that point. I'm reading a lot more in the news now about colleges and universities being forced to close down, especially in the United States. I'm seeing a lot more pressure opposing public funding of higher education institutions, putting more and more of the onus on either students or private donations. That latter has some notable undesirable side effects. In the case of the former, you're asking the people least able to pay, which is people who are uneducated, to pay for an education, which doesn't strike me as reasonable either. I'm seeing as well moves to create a more efficient and cost-effective offering for people through online learning, through, in Canada, initiatives like BC Campus and eCampus Ontario, which are major players in offering free and open access to learning resources. I'm a big supporter of things like that. So we're seeing that more and more. And we're seeing more and more entrenchment on the part of the universities and the colleges saying that, you know, no, you can't automate any of this. No, you can't free up any of this. You have to have the personal touch of a highly paid professional for every educational intervention, a system which is just on a global scale not sustainable. So we're at an inflection point. And we're at the point where we decide whether education is something that will be a social good, part of the infrastructure provided by society, like roads, or is it going to be the type of service that we sell off to the highest bidder and then hope they run it more ethically than they've run other public utilities in the past? It's a hard place right now. It's a hard place because, you know, there were so many external forces leaning on education in a way that they didn't before. You know, the education system we have now was designed originally for the rich, and its purpose was to keep rich people rich. And that's still its structure and function. And yet we've added on this great big tail of public education, and it, you know, it's just a fundamentally inconsistent system. And so one end or another needs to give way.
So what would be your vision then for how this works out? You've obviously thought quite deeply about the potential solutions here. Are you able to share some of them with us?
I'm a supporter of personal learning, where personal learning is a set of frameworks and tools that allow people to access education when and as needed based on things that the person wants to do rather than a certain core curriculum that society thinks that they must have in order to be good workers. And where this personal learning and personal learning environments are supported with strong public support for learning resources created by and for the community, not where we go out and pay publishers tons of money to produce e-textbooks, but rather where we have a system where people in a profession are able to interact freely with people who are aspiring to be part of that profession, where we support the creation of learning materials by and through the activities of people working in the field. It's not a commodity system. We want these learning resources actually to be free and disposable. We want them to be created where and when needed, probably through things like artificial intelligence and automated design, and then just made freely available to people to apply, to use, to build on, to share, to develop with for themselves. Look, I'm not an Ayn Rand individualist or anything remotely like that.
Yeah.
I believe in community. My politics are socialist. I think we do better when we work together. But I don't think we do better when we're forced to work together.
Right.
All right. So I support community, cooperation, all of that. I think those are wonderful things, and I think we should build those in, make those core pieces of our learning network. In fact, it's not a network without all of that. But at the same time, in order for a cooperative system to genuinely produce knowledge, innovation, discovery, creativity, the individuals in that network have to be autonomous. And the collaboration has to be freely entered into. And the mechanisms have to be in place to enable everybody to be a part of the decision-making process. So, I'm the opposite of these Silicon Valley libertarian, move fast, break things, and everyone for themselves, dog-eat-dog kind of world. I think that's a fundamentally flawed view of the world, and especially of technology. But, the idea of collaboration where everybody lines up under a single vision is equally repugnant to me. And I see networks and I see connectivism as the middle point in between, atomism, if you will, and collectivism on the other end. I've been on about networks and that sort of perspective on knowledge and learning since probably the mid-80s, mid to late-80s. I remember sitting down and writing out basically a first draft of it at the Edmonton Folk Festival up high on top of the hill, all by myself. That was back in the days when you could do that. And just watching the Folk Festival and writing it all out in 3 days. That was a first draft, right? And it's been added to and revised a lot since then.
Stephen, I'm going to provide you with an imaginary budget now of everything. If you had a completely unlimited budget, what research would you fund? What research would you most like to see?
If I had a reasonably but not arbitrarily large budget.
That might be a better way.
Yeah. I'd be building something like an individual, I don't even want to say learning environment, because it needs to be more than that. People are developing now decentralized versions of various applications. So we have Mastodon, which is a distributed, decentralized version of Twitter. There's PeerTube, I think it's called, which is a decentralized video sharing site. There's a site that I was just looking at today called Mobilizon. It's a distributed group and or decentralized group and event functionality. And people should have that. I mean, one of the things about the web that didn't work the way we wanted it to work was that it became a reading environment, a consuming environment, rather than a reading and creation environment. You know, when you access the internet, you get, you know, say 20 megabits down, a tenth of a megabit up. Right? Yeah. It might as well be TV. And that's been a source of real disparity on the internet. You know, I mean, it's the internet is so much easier to create and share on than TV or radio, but it's still hard. And I want to make it easy, and I want to make these functionalities available to people on a decentralized basis. So each person can have their own individual Facebook and YouTube and whatever, where these can be used to store and share whatever, and then they can connect with whomever and share these resources, share their photos, their videos, their comments, the work that they do, all of that. Because that's how you learn, is by creating and sharing this stuff. That's what I'd like to see. And there's a lot of forces working against that, right? There's the force that says, you know, well, people don't really need upload, and they shouldn't have their own servers anyways, because they'd be irresponsible with them. So we have to leave it all in the hands of our responsible stewards, like Facebook and Twitter. And then there's also the other set of forces that say, well, yeah, I mean, people should be able to create and share, but only if that can be monetized somehow. And so, you know, they should contribute free and open educational resources, but only under a CC BY license, so that some company can come along and take that content and sell it. So there's a lot of forces against this idea of people creating and freely sharing, you know, without this whole view to you know, how much can I sell it for? How much can I make? What can I make from other people? How do I commoditize this? If we could get learning online to be more like language and less like magazine publishing, I think the technology to support that is the sort of thing that I would want to build.
Yeah, so it's pretty much a commercial free infrastructure where people are allowed to, well, to flourish, I think, for want of a better term.
Yeah, and people say, well, that's totally impractical. We can't have that, but we do have that. We have that in lots of places, like language. You and I are speaking English. Neither of us paid any rights to do that. You know, in fact, our governments freely gave us the tools to acquire that capacity. In fact, they basically insisted on it. You know, they said, look, you will learn language. We really want you to. We want you to be able to speak, to read, to write. And to this day, we're still not paying royalties for the use of this, that, or the other word, with some rare exceptions. You know, so it's not unthinkable. It's just perfectly conceivable. You know, mathematics, right? Nobody owns mathematics. Now, if I say 1 plus 1 equals 2, I don't need to say 1 plus 1 equals 2, sponsored by Apple, licensed under Creative Commons. Right? I just say 1 plus 1 equals 2.
Yeah.
What's weird about that? And why can't those principles apply to wider domains of knowledge? You know, maybe out there on the edges, sure, then you can monetize, right? You know, if you're going to develop a high-end product, you know, especially a physical product, but even, you know, high-end products, intellectual products, sure, okay. You know, I mean, I happily paid money for my edition of No Man's Sky, which is an incredibly complex and very fun video game. Hmm. You know, that, sure. But, you know, the scale of the commercialization of ordinary, everyday knowledge and exchange, I think, is out of hand. Mm-hmm. And I think it very much benefits the already wealthy at the expense of the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah. So the democratization of knowledge, that's very much at the heart of what you're saying there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Stephen, I'd like to finish with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you, and one who you think might otherwise have an important perspective to share.
One name I'll put in is Grainne Kanol.
Yes, yep.
Okay. I don't think you've interviewed her yet, right?
I haven't, no, but I do know Grainne.
Yeah. And this is specifically for some of the stuff on open pedagogy. There's an interesting movement in the world of open education. We've gone away from open education as technology and systems to open education as pedagogy or sociology. A very interesting shift over the years. Not all of which I'm in approval of, but that's a separate issue. But, you know, she's done work in that area, important work in that area,
yep.
And would make a very good interview subject. Mm. And also it adds another person from that great India trip of a number of years ago. The second person I'm going to nominate, so Paul Stacey. I know you've interviewed David Porter already.
Yeah.
And in my mind, Paul Stacey and David Porter are two of a set, and you should finish the set, obviously.
Excellent, thank you.
And then there's another 80.
Stephen, thank you so much for that. It's been a very inspirational interview for me. I haven't really taken the time to learn more about where you're really coming from, and I think you've articulated that extremely well during this interview. Thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thanks, my pleasure.
You can learn more about Stephen and his work and subscribe to his OL Daily newsletter from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.